Fortnight in Film is a podcast where every week you get the chance to listen in on a group of film lovers chatting about the great, or not so great, movies that we've been watching over the past fortnight. Hello and welcome to episode 35 of A Fortnight in Film. I'm your host, Jason. Thanks for tuning in. We have a special guest on the podcast today, a newbie, somebody who's never been on before. So welcome to the podcast, Pete.
Hey, how you doing, Jason and listeners? How are you?
Thanks for coming on. To start, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? And I believe you have a podcast of your own as well.
I do. So myself, I'm a very average person living in suburban America, Northern California. I run a body shop. I have a couple old cars, got a couple dogs, a couple turtles. Ultimately, probably my number one passion outside of, you know, my work and my family is the movies. I watch a ton of movies. I've watched 525 last year. I'm on track to probably do about 550 this year. We have a show, me and my two friends, Joseph and Tyler, we have a show called Middle Class Film Class. It's another movie podcast. And it's a lot of fun. It's fun. It's funny. And it's very, we don't really hold back very much. And I know that sounds like, oh, we're shocking. We're trying to be shocking. But it's just three friends talking about movies. So we'll get off on tangents and talk about, you know, ridiculous things and current events and communism or whatever, you know, just literally anything, you know, Army Hammer allegedly being a cannibal, you know, whatever. So, but it's called Middle Class Film Class. And what makes us a little different than most movie shows is that we record live to tape, like a morning radio show. So it's music entered in live, sound effects done in live, and we interact a lot with our listeners. So if you write into the show, it's going to be read on air. We'll have discussions outside of the show on our Facebook page or through Twitter or whatever. So it's a lot of fun. If you're a movie fan and you just want to get on board and hear some interesting stuff, it's twice a week, Mondays and Wednesdays, and it's a lot of fun.
Heads up. The films we're about to discuss may contain spoilers. For a list of the movies we cover this week, check out the description. So, let's kick it off with my pick. And quick side note before we start, I didn't realize when we were picking our films for this week, but we've inadvertently got a sort of themed episode of sorts because all three films we're discussing are adaptations of novels, which I don't know that we've had that before, and obviously we didn't purposefully do that this week. But yes, I realized as I was looking them up, I'm like, oh, they're all adaptations. So we'll kick it off with my pick, which is A Little Princess from 1995, directed by Alfonso Cuarón. Is that how you say his last name?
Yeah, Cuarón.
Okay, I got it. I'm very bad at pronouncing names usually. Adapted from a 1905 novel by the same name by Frances Hodgson Burnett. And there was also a film adaptation in 1939, which was directed by Walter Lang and starred young Shirley Temple as the eponymous Little Princess. So this one is obviously much later. It stars Liesl Matthews as the princess of sorts, Sarah Crewe. I didn't really recognize any other names in it. Eleanor Bron is the sort of like matron.
The father, Liam, plays Liam Cunningham. He's a young Liam Cunningham. He's from Game of Thrones, Davos Seaworth or something like that.
Okay. See, I'm one of the rare few people who never got around to watching Game of Thrones. So so the plot is Sarah, who is, I don't know if she's actually ever given an age. I guess she's like 8, 9, 10, somewhere around there.
I want to say she's around 9 or 10 or something like that.
And her father, who are living in India. So I guess her father's English, but she's American for some strange reason. I guess like maybe her mother was American.
Could be, yeah. That tracks.
So he signs up to, so it's set during World War One. He signs up to fight for the British Army in World War One, and thus he sends her to a boarding school in New York City. And she gets to this boarding school, and she's a very sort of, I guess, fanciful,
kind of lighthearted and
lighthearted, yeah. Dreamer sort of girl. Like, you know, she thinks, oh, you know, every girl is a princess, and she tells all these fantastic stories which she makes up in her head and entertains all the other girls. If a word comes in later that's actually turns out to be false, that her father has died, thus the tuition money will be drying up. So she goes from having the best room in the boarding house with all her toys to being shunted upstairs and told you're now a servant and you have to earn your pay and your right to stay here.
You're working off your debt to all this time I've put up for you and this nice birthday party and stuff. You're going to work it off and you're lucky I give you that.
Yeah. So it sort of follows her as she, you know, adjusts to her change in living circumstances. And at the same time, her father is revealed to not have died. It was a misidentification. It was actually the son of, I guess, a neighbor of the boarding school, which old man. It was actually his son who died. They end up taking the father in because they think that, you know, the father and the son serve together, and so Richard might have some idea about what happened to this guy's son, John. But Richard is suffering from amnesia, so he doesn't know who he is or where he is or, you know, that it's his daughter in this boarding house. So anyway, the film goes on, and Sarah, you know, rallies the girls against Miss Minchin, and they all, you know, have lots of fun. And then there's this sort of weird side plot with this Indian, like, butler guy who's with the old guy, and he, you know, helps, like, bring Sarah's stories to life. I mean, it creates this huge banquet and everything, which Miss Minchin thinks that Sarah stole. So she calls the police to come and take her away, but she sneaks across to the house of this old guy where her father is, and as they go to arrest her, Richard's memory suddenly comes back and he remembers, no, that's my daughter. And the film ends with the old rich neighbor next door ends up buying the boarding house, and it becomes a much more nicer place. Richard and Sarah leave along with another girl called Becky, who is a young African-American girl who was another servant of Miss Minchin's. He adopts her. They leave, and everyone lives happily ever after, pretty much. So that is the plot. I hated it. I gave it 1 star. I'll get into later. I picked the wrong film, and I'll say why after. But I'm keen to hear what you thought. So what did you think?
Well, this is my second time watching this, and the first time I watched it, I was like, high praise was heaped on it. I was like, oh yeah, a little princess. Oh, so cute, so adorable. And I didn't quite like it the first time. I think I was looking for something a little bit more high energy, and this has a very somber tone to the whole movie. The acting, I think, it's serviceable for child acting, but the Miss Minchin is deplorable. She's one of the worst villainesses I've ever seen in cinema. She's so terrible. I mean, she's got a young African American slave girl in the attic serving the children, and they're like, you can't talk to her. Don't even look at her. Don't even look. And she's teaching all the other young girls that's normal because of her skin color. It doesn't outright say that the teacher, you know, Miss Minchin saying that, but the second time I watched it, I liked it a lot more. You know, I still thought there was a lot of room for improvement, but, you know, seeing his Alfonso Cuarón's early work and seeing where he went, I really don't see like a straight line connecting this to something like Children of Men or whatever, you know. I'm glad that he was able to cut his teeth on something like this so he could make something great like that. I think that the relationship between the very sad girl and the way that she copes with the loss of her mother was really, it was impactful for me. And then at the end, when the father doesn't even recognize her, I was like, man, this is like gaslighting 101, because I was thinking, man, is that him? Maybe that's not him. Maybe that's someone else. Cause he's like, I don't know you. I'm not your father. So I was like, this poor girl, maybe she's going insane. Maybe I'm going insane. And then when he finally runs out in the rain and he's like hugging her and stuff, I wept. I was so happy that it happened. So a little cheesy pie, a little bit like on the nose in some of it, but interesting story. And yeah, I mean, I'm glad I rewatched it. Probably will never watch it again though.
Yeah, actually on that point about Alfonso Cuarón's, I guess, journey for a film, he's quite an interesting filmmaker when you look at what he's done. So he obviously did this.
He did one Harry Potter film, the third one, Prisoner of Azkaban. He did Children of Men, which a lot of people love. I didn't think that highly of it, but everyone else seems to. He did Roma in 2018, which I remember when that came out, it just swept the Academy Awards and just like killed the award circuit. Like it was just, I remember, I haven't seen it, I want to see it, but I remember when it came out and I wasn't really into film then, but I just remember hearing everyone praise it. And he did Gravity, which I actually love Gravity. I think Gravity is like a 5-star film. I think that's fantastic. So he's done a lot of different stuff. He's done Y2 Mama Tambien as well in 2001. He did Great Expectations in 1998 with Ethan Hawke and Gwyneth Paltrow. Yeah, so he's done a lot of different stuff. He's quite an interesting filmmaker. He's not just stuck to one genre or one area. He's sort of jumped a bit all over the place. So that, I think, is an interesting little side note. But for me, look.
Where's your heart, child?
I don't have one. See, this is the thing. I don't have one. I have no heart. Christian and George have lambasted me before for basically being heartless and soulless and showing no emotion or anything. So. Sure. I just, you know, so the acting, okay, I wasn't really a fan of the acting, but the big thing that stood out for me that really annoyed me was, like, the dialogue. Like, and when I realized it had been, I don't think I realized when I first started watching it, but then I looked it up and I'm like, oh, it's from a book. Before I knew it was from a book, I had the thought of, like, they're speaking like a book. Like you know, the dialogue was like... you know, like people would speak in a book. It wasn't to me how people would speak in real life. Because the dialogue just seemed so over the top and even just their delivery seemed so over the top and it was, you know, written and delivered like some fantastical tale, which I guess is the point of it and I guess ties into these whole, you know, stories that Sarah tells. But that just really annoyed me the whole way through because I'm like, wow, they're trying way too hard. And it's you know, I guess it's part of that whole, which I know, and I said, I'll get into this in a second, I picked the wrong film. If I'd known it was this sort of magical realism sort of thing, I probably wouldn't have picked it because I know I'm not a fan of that. So for context, so I picked this, so there were 4 films coming off Netflix in Australia at the end of the month. And I thought, okay, I need to watch them before they come off the service. So this was one of them. The others were In the Name of a Father from 1993, which is I yet to watch, but I'm doing that tonight. Midway from 2019, and Time to Kill from 1996. Now, I wasn't biggest fan of Midway. It wasn't an awful film, but I gave it 2 stars. I wasn't particularly impressed. It's by Roland Emmerich, who just makes, you know, if you know anything about him, he just makes ridiculous, over the top films. The only film I've seen of his that I actually enjoyed was The Patriot with Mel Gibson. I thought that was a really good film, but the rest of them are just big epic things of ridiculous proportions. You know, he did Independence Day, he did 2012, he did The Day After Tomorrow, 10,000 BC. Yeah, so that was that. And A Time to Kill, I loved. I watched it the other night. I became very close to giving it 5 stars. And I don't really know what's holding me back from, I have it 4.5, but that I thought was fantastic. So I sort of wish I'd picked that. Obviously I couldn't because it was after the fact. I'm like, I really wish I picked that because I could spend so much time talking about how great that movie was. And I actually want to go out and buy the book. I think that's actually also an adaptation from a John Grisham novel, which I want to go and buy because I thought the movie was fantastic. So if I'd had my way again, I would have picked that. But alas, I picked The Little Princess. I think precocious children annoy me in films. Like, and Sarah, I guess, is a very sort of world-wise, precocious, you know.
I speak French better than you do, Miss Minchin.
Yeah. And it's just like, no one behaves like that. Like, no child ever acts like that. You know, like, it just annoyed me. I'm just like, you're not acting like a child would. I did find it, and I guess, you know, this is the point of it. It's, I guess, I guess you call it a kid's movie in parts, but it's, I guess, you know, a story, you know, so I found it just predictable what happens, you know. Well, of course, the good people win and, you know, Miss Minchin gets banished to be a chimney sweeper and her father, you know, miraculously ends up in their house next door and at a crucial moment he just regains his memory like that and, oh, well, yes, that is my daughter. I was like, God, this is so predictable, you know, which I guess is the point of it. And maybe, you know, I was reading some reviews of it and people were like, oh my God, I loved this so much as a kid. So maybe it's one of those films where if I'd seen it as a child, I mean, this I was only born in 1994, so it only came out a year after I was born. But if I'd seen it as a child, maybe I would have, you know, held it up there higher. Like if I'd seen it as a kid and when I rewatch it now as an adult, I probably wouldn't dislike it as much as I do now watching it as an adult, when I guess it's somewhat designed for kids in a sense.
Well, this would be a good movie to like show a young kid maybe and say, well, you know, bad things can happen to you in life. As long as you keep a happy spirit, things are going to be okay.
Right. Like, yeah, the message, I have no problem with the message. I'm not I am a pessimist, but I have no problem with the message. It's more just like how it was delivered as such.
Sure. Yeah, that's fair.
And that whole thing about that, you know, Indian guy, and oh, he's able to set up this whole bedroom without anyone knowing. I'm like, what? Like, what world are we entering into? Like, are we entering into like an alternate reality? Like, what's going on here? Like,
yeah, now it's a fantasy.
Yeah. So yeah, that was that film. So
I think I gave it 3 stars.
Can't say I was a fan of my own pick, but that seems to be happening more and more lately. So so we'll move on to a film that I enjoyed more than this, which was your pick. So take it away.
Paul Thomas Anderson is, in my opinion, one of the greatest living acting, like still producing directors of our generation. So fantastic. I love his movies, damn near every single one of them. Phantom Thread has become like neck and neck for me with There Will Be Blood, with my favorite Paul Thomas Anderson movie. After I watched it a few times, it just really took off. So the only movie I haven't seen in his catalog, feature length film, has been Inherent Vice. And I've kind of stayed away from it because most people are like, well, it's not as good as the other ones. It's not in the same league. So I was kind of staying away from it. So this is Inherent Vice. Is released in 2014, written and directed by Paul Thomas Anderson, as you might guess, starring Joaquin Phoenix as Doc, the character of Doc, which is his real name is Larry Sportello. He's a private eye in Southern California, somewhere near the beach. Josh Brolin plays a detective. Owen Wilson plays Coy Harrington. Catherine Watterson plays his main squeeze, on again, off again squeeze. Joanna Newsom, Jordan Christian Hearn, and then a lot of like people that you recognize in very, very small parts. Like Maya Rudolph was in this for a moment. Eric Roberts was in this for a moment. Michael Kenneth Williams was in this for a moment. And do you watch BoJack Horseman, Jason?
I do not.
Okay.
But
there's a character who's a pug. Her name is Pickles, and that play in that movie or in that show. And she voices the masseuse, the Asian masseuse named Jade. Hong Chow is her name, the actress.
And there's also Reese Witherspoon and Benicio del Toro as well. So
yep.
As you'd expect for Paul Thomas Anderson film, fairly big name people.
Always. The story of Inherent Vice is basically, it's a mishmash to me of The Big Lebowski, and probably most dramatically similar would be like Under the Silver Lake. Really interesting sort of like a spy thriller, private eye detective sort of thing. And there's a million moving parts and there's characters that all know Doc's name. And I don't know who this guy is and who that person is. And I feel like some people are playing multiple parts. And man, that whole part of it was really confusing to me. I feel like this is a movie you have to watch 2 or 3 times before you really get the nuance of the story. But behind it all is this really interesting corruption and drug scandal and blah, blah, blah. And it's all told from the perspective of this total hippie played by Joaquin Phoenix. Giant mutton chops, smoke, and almost every scene he's smoking a joint. Sometimes he's smoking a joint and a cigar at the same time, typing away with a joint in his hand. And he's just got like women falling into his lap, just constantly like, oh, hey, Doc, you want to come over and spend the night with me? Sure, man, no problem, let's do it. And he's almost like fighting them away, like some of them, you know. But it's told from this perspective, this kind of bumbling cop, not cop, private eye, who is at ends with the police. They're kind of constantly like trying to, I don't know the other one, it was like Ace Ventura. He's a character who is a private eye who the cops hate, but he's good at his job, as eccentric as he may be. And that was Doc in this. Because at the end of the line, once he discovers what's happening, after all the coke he's snorted and all the drugs he's smoked and all the women he's bedded, he gets to the end of the line and finds the corruption and finds the corrupt Josh Brolin trying to import this drugs he's taking from the Golden Fang. And it was really interesting, really interesting. So the vibe hit me just right. The story was a little too convoluted to catch on a single watch, but I feel like every time I watch a Paul Thomas Anderson movie, on a rewatch, I appreciate it more the second time. So this will be one I'll revisit for sure.
So I gave it 3 stars. I didn't have a heart to tell you when you picked it. So I'll preface this. We generally, when we pick films, the only time that I think any of us have ever turned down a film is because we can't get a hold of it. Like, we've never, like, to my memory, no one's ever picked a film and been like, no, I don't want to watch that sort of thing. I mean, I stepped back to George and Christian when we first started. I'm like, look, we all have veto powers. If you ever don't want to watch anything, just like say and we'll pick something else. I don't think we've ever exercised those veto powers yet, but I can recall. Most of the time, if we say no to a film, it's like, oh, we can't get a hold of it. And so, as such, I've watched a lot of films, which I knew I wouldn't like. And I'm sure George and Christian have watched a lot of my picks that they probably knew they wouldn't like. Although, as we were saying before we started, they're a lot more generous with their ratings than I am. So when you picked it, I was like, oh God, poor Thomas Anderson. Like, I'm
not a fan.
I'm not a fan. George and I actually did a mini sort of Paul Thomas Anderson episode a few episodes ago, episode 32, I think it was, where we did Licorice Pizza, The Master, and There'll Be Blood. And I have watched Magnolia before, which I discussed with someone, I think it was George, on the podcast. So I hated Magnolia, and I hated Licorice Pizza. The Master, I wasn't the biggest fan of. I gave 2 stars, but I could appreciate like what it was trying to do. There'll Be Blood, I thought was great. I gave 4 stars, and I was leaning towards giving it more, like 4.5. Of what I was really, really
oh cool.
Film. So this film, I went into it. And I try not to do this, but we're all guilty of it. Like, you know, sometimes you'll, I guess you might know this too, because you have a podcast. Like, someone picks a film, and you're like, oh, I'm probably not going to like this. So I went into it knowing it was Paul Thomas Anderson, knowing I don't generally like his films apart from There'll Be Blood. And so I thought, oh, okay, I'll watch it. But it actually, I gave it 3 stars, but I'll say I liked it because I was leaning towards 3.5, which is like in my rating scale, it's like good. So it surprised me because I'm generally not a PTA fan. Look, the storyline was definitely intriguing. It kept me hooked all the way through, because like you said, there's so much going on and there's so much happening, and you, like, it is long. I think it's like 2.5 hours, but I'm still like, I want to find out what happens. Like, I'm in for this now. I'm on the ride. I need to see this through to the end. Like, not that I'm the sort of person who turns off films anyway, but I'm like, I need to see what happens. I need to figure out who's behind this and what's happening at what level and what is the role is this person playing.
Who's Golden? Are they real? Is it all conspiracy? Is he all just a stoner hippie? I was bought in too. I'm glad you were bought in.
I agree. It was incredibly confusing. And I've read that is also because it was adapted from a Thomas Pynchon novel of the same name. And I haven't read any Thomas Pynchon novels, but I know by reputation he's a very confusing author. Perhaps in some ways, like deliberately confusing. Like, he just writes very, from what I've read of his, not that I've read any of his works, but what I've heard of him is that he just writes, I mean, it has here, of Wikipedia. Thomas Pynchon is an American novelist noted for his dense and complex novels. And I think his most famous one is probably Gravity's Rainbow, which is, I've heard, is also incredibly confusing. And this was actually, I believe, the first Thomas Pynchon novel ever adapted to screen. And I read in a review, I think, I can't remember where I read it, it was on a site, I don't know if it was like The Guardian of New York or somewhere, but they said, like, this is the first Thomas Pynchon novel ever adapted film, and it will probably be the last, because you can't adapt them. It's just too hard. And I think that sort of came across in the film. I think, like I said, it was confusing, but I also know PTA likes those sort of confusing films with lots of different plot threads. I mean, Magnolia did that, obviously. Licorice Pizza did that. I mean, you've seen certainly more of his films than I have. I'm sure they all have that common element of like strangeness and interconnected characters and weird goings on. And
there's some movies that they tie it down a little bit, like There Will Be Blood was pretty much constrained just to Daniel Plainview.
Yes, which is probably why I liked it so much. like, this one was interesting because, like you said, you spend the whole time, and I read a lot of analysis on this, and a lot of it was talking about how it sort of aimed to, I guess, encapsulate the sort of paranoia of that era. And you have them, it's set in, I think, in the
1970, I think it's right.
1970, right, which is right after, obviously, the Manson murders, and you've got the hippie movement, and everyone's doing drugs, and you know, it talked a lot of reviews that read talked about how it encapsulates that paranoia about like what's real and like everyone's on drugs. And I guess, you know, there were instances of that in the film, like that Sortilege, how do you say her name? Like, was she even real or was she like an imaginatory thing? I never understood that. The narrator woman.
Oh, the main girl. I think she was real, but I think
because Shasta obviously was real, but then there was that like sort of, I don't know how you say her name, like Sortilege, and it was like she only appeared like in the car or something, and she was like never seen again, but she was narrating the whole way through, and I'm like, are you real? Are you like a figment of his imagination?
I never thought about that. Maybe she is. She could, yeah. I could see it that
way. But I mean, yeah. I mean, like her character, I mean, as I've said ad nauseum on the podcast, I hate narration generally in films. And here it just, like, I think if the narration wasn't there, I probably could bump it up to something like 3.5 stars maybe, because it just, I found it so annoying and so unnecessary. And it it detracted from the film for me, because I'm like, I don't need you the whole way through telling me about, oh, Doc's doing this. This is what Doc is thinking. I'm like, I don't care. Just let me watch a film. It's like, shut up. Let me watch a film. Like, I don't care what you're thinking, whoever you are, figment of his imagination. Like, I don't care. Like,
I think that's kind of a Hollywood staple in detective like dramas too, like noirs. It feels like you can get almost like that, that cliche fits there. And I'm with you. If you don't like, you know, narration and stuff, I totally get that. It seems it's a kind of a cop out. It's a movie that we reviewed on our show called Adaptation.
Charlie with Nicolas Cage. Yeah, I own that, but I'm yet to see it.
So. There's some of it. Charlie Kaufman, the character Charlie Kaufman, played by Nicolas Cage, is narrating what's happening, and he's an author in the movie. He's playing himself. Charlie Kaufman's character, he's playing the real life Charlie Kaufman, a version of him. And in the movie, he goes to a writing seminar where the guy says, if you have narration in your movie, it's a fucking cop out. And he's like, he's narrating when that happens and goes, this guy has no idea what he's talking about. And it's like very meta. That whole movie is an insane movie. But I think that's really interesting. Maybe she is a figment of imagination. I think her character had almost the exact same amount of, I guess, bringing of anything to the table. Like, she added almost nothing, just like Sam Elliott's character of the cowboy in The Big Lebowski added almost nothing to it. It's almost like just this sounding board and lets the audience kind of like work out ideas out loud, but way more obvious. I think you're onto something. I don't think that was 100% necessary.
But look, you know, I thought the acting was good across the board. Phoenix, quickly becoming a big fan of his. So, like, I loved him in Joker. I loved him in Come On, Come On. I thought he was really good in The Master, even though I didn't really like that film. I own Her. I've heard he's very good in that. I think I own Walk the Line. I've heard he's very good in that. So I thought Phoenix was great. I thought Josh Brolin was great. Even Owen Wilson, who, you know, annoys me usually, he was fine. Like,
he was playing his same character from Royal Tenenbaums.
So the acting I thought was good, as you'd expect in a Paul Thomas Anderson film. I thought the visuals were really good, the score was really good. So like, technically I can't complain. The storyline I think was super confusing, but it was intriguing enough that it hooked you. I just think, yeah, if it was maybe just less complex and the narration wasn't there, I could easily see myself giving it 3.5 stars. 3 star, I probably enjoyed it more than my rating attests. And I'm glad I did, because as I said, I don't usually like PTA, but I'm glad.
3 stars is good. 3 stars is above average. So, that's good.
So yeah, good pick. I'm glad I watched it. I'm glad I'm perhaps warming more to PTA. It might redeem me in the eyes of Letterboxd people, who will see my Magnolia on Licorice Pizza ratings. And
I was not a huge Licorice Pizza fan either. Don't be afraid. I was kind of like, okay, I mean, where are they going with this? Right. I gave it 3.5 stars, and I'm looking at my Letterboxd right now. I said 4 stars is my number one, which is true, but 3.5 is like right next to it. I'm usually pretty forgiving on movies that have a good technical aspect, even if I didn't love the movie all out. And this really, it really was a dynamite looking movie.
Yes, I agree. And actually, I meant to ask you at the start of the podcast, but I completely forgot, so I'll ask you now, which I ask all our guests who come on. Do you have a favorite film And if so, what is it? Or films, plural.
Yeah, jockeys back and forth between Whiplash and There Will Be Blood. Those are my top two right now. And that may change a year from now, but they've both been pretty high up there. I've probably seen Whiplash 15 times.
Wow.
I love it. And I love jazz, big band jazz music. A good score makes kind of like just, it's almost like cheating. You know, you get a really great score, a really great soundtrack on a movie, and it just makes it that much better, even if the movie isn't great. But if you look on my Letterboxd, I don't have my favorite four movies listed as my favorites. I have my last five-star movies I've rated.
I've gone back and forth between that too. Sometimes I used to have it where, it was the last four films I gave four more stars to. And then, I don't know, and I probably will go back to that at some point. I said, I'll go back and forth. And then I put my four favorites there. But then even that, I'm like, oh, but I want to put this one in. I want to put that one in. It's so restrictive. I can't.
It's like picking your favorite child.
But, yeah.
So I can't do that. So now I'm like, now I just have to say, sorry, The Fugitive, you're off. Jurassic Park is on now.
Yeah. I probably will go back to that at some point, because even sometimes I look at my letterbox all the time, but I look at my letterbox and I'm like, oh, I really want to put this film there instead of that, but how can I justify taking that off? And it's very difficult. I wish we could just have one big favorite film and that was it, and that would just solve all the problems.
Yeah, you can make a list.
I have a 100 favorite films list. But
oh, do you? My current favorites on Letterboxd is The Fugitive, Phantom Thread, Paranorman, and Jurassic Park.
I think the only one I've seen out of those is The Fugitive, which I liked.
You have not seen Jurassic Park?
See, I probably have at some point when I was a kid. I can't remember it, honestly, but...
Come on!
I'm guessing I probably have when I was like 5 or 6 or something, but I don't even know if I have it. I don't even think I have it like marked as watch on Letterboxd.
It's a sci-fi fantasy and somewhere in that middle of genre, because they explain it in a way that science can happen, but who knows if it's really even possible. So you may not like it if you're not into that sort of thing. But in my opinion, it's one of the most entertaining movies. And start to finish, it's so fantastic.
So on that note, let's move on to our final pick, which comes by the way of George. So this is from 1933. As you'd expect, well, maybe you wouldn't, because this is your first time on a podcast, but George loves his old classic films. He provides all the older films for us to watch. So 1933, directed by James Whale, adapted from, it's called The Invisible Man, adapted from the H.G. Wells novel, The Invisible Man, which was released in 1897. So it stars Claude Rains as the Invisible Man, Dr. Jack Griffin, Henry Travers, Gloria Stewart, William Harrigan. They make up sort of the rest of the main cast. So the plot follows Dr. Griffin, who has he's a scientist, and he's made himself invisible through coming up with this concoction of chemicals that he's injected into himself, and he's now invisible, and he's trying to find a way to become uninvisible. So he goes into this pub, it's said in England, which surprised me. I guess for some reason I thought it was American. And then they went into this pub and it was like, oh, we're in England in like whenever this is said. So he goes into this pub and he asks for a room, and he says, like, do not disturb me, I need to work. And he keeps getting disturbed. So he ends up, you know, revealing to everyone that he's invisible, which obviously shocks them. He runs off. He goes to the home of one of the scientists he works with, Dr. Kemp, and says, you know, I've made myself invisible. I need somewhere to stay. I need somewhere to work. And I need a partner to help me take over the world. You know, I'm invisible and I'm going to terrorize everyone. And
an invisible man sitting on the visible throne. I think that's what he said, something like that.
Dr. Kemp sort of reluctantly agrees, because the invisible man says, oh, if you don't do this, I'll kill you. And he's already shown he's capable of that, or he does later on anyway. It follows the invisible man's exploits. The police and, you know, the townspeople are trying to catch him. And Kemp ends up calling the police, which he obviously does not like. After doing all sorts of things, he derails the train, he throws some people off off a cliff. He says to Dr. Kim, he says, I'm going to kill you at 10 o'clock tomorrow night. And the police try and put all these plans in place, like they have him going to the police station and they have him walk out in like a policeman's uniform, so he's like a decoy. But of course, the Invisible Man is always one step ahead of him, laying in wait in the back of Dr. Kim's car, who he proceeds to send over a cliff and kills him. A snowstorm, which I guess is the thing that drives him to the pub in the first place at the beginning of the film, is there's a snowstorm and he's looking for shelter. Another snowstorm at the end of the film forces him to seek shelter in this barn. He falls asleep, and the farmer comes in the next morning, and he obviously can't see him, but he can hear that there's this person in his barn, and he tells the police, oh, the Invisible Man is in my barn. So they sort of smoke him out, set the barn on fire, and because it's snow, they sort of see his footprints in the snow, and as he comes towards them, they shoot him. He dies. You know, there's a sort of subplot of one of the scientists, his daughter is like, I read in Wikipedia, but it's never really referenced in the film, I don't think. They're apparently engaged. I thought she just sort of had a thing for him, but apparently they're engaged. She comes to him at the end of the film as he's dying, and he says, you know, I meddled in things that man must leave alone. And then as he dies, his invisibility potion, whatever you want to call it, wears off, and he sort of returns to his normal human form. And the film ends. So I very much enjoyed it. I gave it 4 stars. What did you think?
My ranking was 3 stars. And mainly the lower ranking is mainly because of the production of it, the value of it. Like, if I were to put myself in that era, it's probably a fantastically made movie, but I'm not. I'm in 2022, and the sound effects are atrocious. The laughing and the screaming it's like grating to my ears. I can't stand it when an old movie has the like blown out audio and you're like, oh, kill me, please. But the story was pretty compelling, and it was a lot more like direct. The character was a lot more direct than I was expecting. He's an actual sociopath. Like, if you're gonna get in my way, I'm just gonna murder you, you know? And yeah. Like, oh shit, okay, cool. They did that in the 30s, great. But I like the way the story moved and stuff. And, you know, the only really character I cared about too much was him, which is great, I guess. And the fact that it was Claude Rains at the end, I'm like, oh, what? That's like 1930s stunt casting.
Yeah.
It's like putting Vin Diesel as the voice of Groot.
Yeah. For me, you know, it's funny you mentioned that screaming, because that landlady woman was just, I think, spent half the film screaming, which was sort of like unintentionally hilarious to me. I was just like, I just had to laugh at it, because I'm like, it's so over top and ridiculous.
Her whole character was over the top and ridiculous.
Yeah. But I will say, I did think the acting was good, even if it was a bit over the top at times. But I think that's sort of reminiscent of that era. I mean, this is actually the oldest film I've ever watched. The only other two films I've seen from the 30s are Gone with the Wind and Wizard of Oz, both which from 1939, both which I love. So this is the oldest film I've ever seen. I'm sure for George it's par for the course, because he loves his 30s flicks, but this was an oldie for me. But yeah, I think, you know, of that era and sort of into the 40s as well, some of the acting can be a bit OTT at times, but I don't really hold it against it, because that's just sort of the era it was made in, and that's how people acted, I guess. Yeah, I mean, I thought Claude Rains was good, and it's tough for him because obviously he's having to do so much with his voice. Like, there's no facial expressions, he has body movements and stuff, but a lot of it is just, like you said, menacing people through his voice or whatever, which I think is hard to do, and I think he did a good job doing that. As a brief side note, it was nice to see Henry Travers in something, who I've only known as Clarence from It's a Wonderful Life, which I love that film. So it was nice to see, like, oh, it's Clarence, but not as an angel. Look, I think technically, you know, I mean, George could be able to speak to this far more than I, but I think of that era, you know, films of that era were technically good. And I think, you know, the cinematography, the score, all of that I really can't fault. And I, you know, for me, I liked the fact that we saw some of the main people dying. Like, we obviously saw Dr. Kemp die, and then we obviously saw the main character die at the end. I mean, I always like when that happens, because I think a lot of films are just too scared. And obviously, this is different. It's adapted from a book, so we have to stay within the source material. But a lot of films are too scared to sort of kill off their main characters. So I always like when that happens, because I'm like, which I said the credit really has to go to H.G. Wells because he wrote the book. But yeah, it's I like that aspect of it because I didn't know. I thought maybe he's going to get away again. You know, maybe they're going to try and catch him at the end of a snowstorm and he's going to escape and go on some reign of terror. So I sort of liked it. They finally got him. It's like, bang, he's dead. And that was it. I don't think the whole romantic angle, what little there was of it between him and Flora, really added anything. Like, it was sort of unnecessary. They could have just not had her there.
I think for that short of a movie, it probably, it's never going to be very effective because you just don't have enough time to set that up.
No. And obviously they were apart for the majority of the film for all but a few minutes. So she sort of was a redundant character in my mind. But yeah, look, I think, you know, it was, I like that it was a quick movie. It was only 70 minutes, so just over an hour. So I like that because I do have a problem when movies drag on. So I think it was good that it was fast paced and it obviously covered a lot of ground in those 70 minutes, which when you think about it is tough to do. Like, you only have over an hour, but you have to sort of tell the story of this guy becoming invisible and all his, I don't say hijinks, but that seems too light of a word for like murder and stuff, but all his criminal exploits, murderous exploits, and then obviously his death. To tell that story in that short time frame, I think it did that well.
It was kind of funny to see all his like wild stuff, and his hijinks ranged from slapping somebody on the face and pinching their butt to bludgeoning a police, strangling a police officer and pushing a man off of a cliff in a car. Like, sometimes he's just cheeky and fun, and sometimes he's an actual sociopath.
Yeah. Well, you know, his whole point was, you know, I'm going to, you know, take over the world and I'm going to, you know, show everyone what I can do sort of thing.
Yeah, I did find it relatable too that his whole catalyst that sent him on his murderous rampage in the first place was somebody bothering him when he didn't want to be bothered. I find that relatable. Go away. Yeah, but can I just ask you a question? No, just go. Yeah, but it's just, I just want to bring you some tea. All right, time to start killing.
And yeah, it's that interesting thing of, you know, everybody, you know, you ask people, oh, what superpower do you wish you have? A lot of people would say invisibility. A lot of people just wanted to mess with other people and, oh, I'm going to open and shut a door and people aren't going to know who it is. Ha, ha, ha. But there probably are some people who would want invisibility to go and commit whatever sort of acts they want to commit.
Sure.
And no one could catch them.
Yeah.
So I think I liked his, I guess, evilness.
It was refreshingly evil.
Yes. So good pick, George. I don't have much else to say about it. Thanks for coming on. Been great to have you as a guest, and I hope we can get you on again at some point soon.
It was fun though. Yeah, thanks for having me on and talking with me about this.
Well, I think that wraps up episode 35. Thanks everyone for tuning in. As always, if you enjoyed today's podcast, we'd love it if you could give us a rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and we'll see you next week.